I'm Brian McCreath. I'm at Symphony Hall with John Harbison, and he is the composer of the Symphony No. 2, played by the BSO this week with Sir Andrew Davis. John, thanks for a little bit of your time today.
I'm delighted to be here.
So the Symphony No. 2, I found it interesting as a part of the program that acknowledges and celebrates your 80th birthday as one of the symphonies that you actually didn't write for the BSO. You've written other symphonies for them, but tell me about the choice of this symphony for this concert and whether that was something that the BSO wanted or if this was your suggestion to them to use the Symphony No. 2 as part of their celebration of your career.
They chose the piece, and I'm glad they did. It's certainly a piece I hold in, you know, very close regard. I mean, it was written for San Francisco Symphony, and it was a time sort of in the mid-80s where I was very prone to sort of dark periods. I was thinking about, in this piece, this idea of the times of day and particularly engaging with the effect of light on us, on our moods and on our kind of general responses to life. And so each of the movements sort of settles in on a certain time of day.
Right, right.
And the piece ends with a very hard message in a way. The last movement is probably the starkest and most, shall we say, just conflicted. Even the ending doesn't try to really sum things up in a very neat way. In fact, I was just talking to Sir Andrew Davis about the character of the ending, asking him to be a little less warm to it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because I think where it needs to reside is a place that's not completely comfortable. I was fortunate in the first performance of this piece to have a very good engagement with it from Herbert Blomstedt.
Who was at that time the director
who was
of the
in San Francisco,
San Francisco
at the yeah. time, yeah. Who did the piece and then did something with it which a composer of our era seldom experiences, which is he brought it back in a subsequent season, in fact, twice.
And he recorded it for commercial release.
And he recorded
release.
It, yeah. yes. Yeah. So all of those things are very unusual. And the most unusual part for me was understanding something I had never been able to verify, which is that if an orchestra comes back soon to a piece, the level of retention and of engagement with the piece is so much more exponentially important than I ever could have guessed.
Wow.
I always thought it would be true because I'd heard standard works coming back and always heard them, even if they were already standard works, more eloquently portrayed because the players bring to it the recent experience. But it was a shock to me how quickly the music came back to the San Francisco Symphony when they returned
yeah.
to it.
Yeah.
It was also a depressing kind of knowledge because, you know, it very, very, very seldom happens in this era.
So you begin to think, what if more of my pieces
exactly.
had this kind of treatment?
You begin sure. to think, if this piece, which is quite difficult, emerged in such a different form and was so much more at the hands of the players in this quick reiteration. It makes more difference than I ever imagined. Of course, I always really felt that the standard works, the ones that come back very often to the orchestra, mm-hmm. They begin rehearsal at a completely different juncture than new pieces.
Sure, yeah.
They are just in another part of a journey, and if you were to put it on a map, it would be a long distance on a map.
Yeah.
That first reading of, say, the Beethoven Symphony that is almost always going to come every couple of years,
yeah.
is not a reading at all. You know, it is another investigation of territory which is already familiar.
Well, and to that point, I mean, the recent experience of the BSO on tour, when they had to suddenly come up with a different program, it was Beethoven 7 they turned to because they knew they could just do a sound check and play it
absolutely.
At the Concertgebouw.
Yeah, there are pieces which our great orchestras simply are ready to play.
Yeah, yeah.
This piece is now quite a long time since it came here. Mm-hmm. Some players certainly were here and played it. And
it was 2010, I think?
Yeah, right? And I think there is a kind of residual memory of every piece that an orchestra plays that that makes a difference. But it is tremendously important, actually, to remember, I guess, for us, both composers and listeners, everybody, that absorption is probably as much of a performance as actual minutes on stage rehearsing.
That must be the case for any piece, of course. But this particular symphony, knowing the music of yours that I do know, which I can't say is comprehensive, but I do know some of your pieces, this one strikes me as more than usual for your music, reliant or takes advantage of texture and blend in a way that I think of a lot of your pieces as really kind of based in a rhythmic sort of language and a really exciting visceral rhythmic language. But this one, while there is exciting visceral rhythmic parts to it, it's so much about texture, so much about color, and that must also lend itself to that kind of growth within a musician when they play it as a
very, very much so. Yeah, it's an elaborate. I go through periods where I write more or less elaborately, depending on sort of what kind of character I'm looking for. And there are a lot of places in this piece where foreground and background are deliberately confused. That is, the main tunes often in this piece are fighting their way through a rather dense foliage. I actually thought of it as like foliage, like leaves and trees and stuff, the thing growing around the tunes. And that's something I would actually be doing rather seldom. It was for this occasion that I was thinking a lot about this.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that I was sort of on the right track with that, it stands out a little bit.
And I was thinking, it was a little bit like the orchestration of my favorite orchestration, actually, of Bach and the cantatas, where there isn't the kind of foregrounding of principal voices that you would find in later scores. It's almost that performers have to make decisions about that, and I think that's also true here. I think there are many times where, in the slow mode, the sort of major tune has an awful lot of commentary going on around it. And I actually thought of that commentary I sort of had words for some of it, and some of it I remember, the forest creatures and heavy growth in the forest, that kind of thing, because it seemed important to me that the nature of the tunes were something that we had to hunt for. It's much less likely to happen in most of my other pieces. Much of what we do as composers is highlighting and foregrounding the things that we want to come through. And I wrote this piece mostly free of that attitude.
That's interesting. And I'm also happy to hear you say that you're drawing allusions to foliage, to forests, things that are beautiful, because when a listener hears density as a description, there's a little bit of an intimidation factor there. This is dense, but it's beautifully dense. It's beautifully textured and layered. And you anticipated another question of mine, which is, I always have to ask you where Bach fits into this, so central in your life, to most musicians' lives. But you mentioned the way that he doesn't foreground things in his cantatas sometimes, I think especially of certain chorale tunes that are layered underneath
something else
going on.
Indeed.
And essentially,
he doesn't foreground. I mean, he seems to weight, his orchestra is sort of a bunch of equally weighted parts.
Yeah.
And there isn't, if you want to say hear a singer in a Bach aria with strings, you actually have to edit such that, because it's all written very importantly in the details. I mean, if you play the viola part in almost any Bach movement, you think you have a very, very cogent and satisfying material.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're not the main voice.
Right.
98% of the time.
Right.
But I think that's one of the things that I was thinking about in this piece, was trying to make textures which were really almost like Richard Carr, the old word Richard Carr, where you look for the subject. And there's kind of a fugue in the last movement, at least I thought it was a fugue. The subject, though, I like the feeling that you're always, your ear's looking for that subject. It's being played, but you are not really being led to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's it's an attitude which really pervades this piece.
Yeah. Well, and now here you are in a year celebrating your 80th birthday, which was last month, but mm-hmm. so many organizations are celebrating your life and your career at this moment. And it gives you a chance for real perspective on your work that you probably never had before. And when it comes to the Symphony No. 2, I don't know if if there are others who have performed this that you've been in the presence of this year, but tell me about what you feel in terms of your perception of it now. You're not the same composer you were in 1987. And what do you hear about yourself? What have you learned about yourself through this symphony specifically during this year?
Well, we go through a lot of times, and I realize as I get to 80, there are things that we can take along, and most of everything we shed. That is to say, there are things that I would like to be able to do, but it's not in my ears anymore to do it. So when I hear the music of this period, I think of a kind of profusion of detail, which is much less likely to come into my mind now.
Hmm.
I tend to want to hear now much fewer notes and much shorter phrases, and perhaps signify things in a more of a shorthand. But I think that's something that happens to a lot of composers as they get older, because you have a background of having done many things and you don't want to do them again. And that particularly means you don't want to expand things in the same way. You almost want to find ways to say everything or to do everything more compactly. That will be the first thing when I hear this piece. I think this seems like a great deal of Midnight Oil, or what or what Alec Wilder in his popular songbook calls the green eyeshade went into.
That's right.
The making of this piece that is not the kind of effort I would be making now.
Yeah, and at the same time, I've always understood from composers, and it sounds like you're getting at this, that there so many composers place such a high value on what they call economy, that there's an economy of expression, that you say as much as you can, but with as little as you need mm-hmm. to, and so it sounds like that's you describe it as a way of not repeating yourself. I've done this. I don't want to do that again. But it's also maybe, yeah. I suggest to you that maybe right now your economy of expression is so refined, so heightened, that you can say way more in a lower number of notes than you ever really did before.
Though paradoxically, when I hear this piece, I would love to be able to be this abundant again.
Yeah, okay, okay.
I just don't have those drawerfuls of both textural and melodic kinds of elaborations. That's just not coming into my head.
Wow.
And so a friend of mine used to kid me about years ago about being jealous of not being able to do this or that anymore. But I think that's a normal thing. I mean, there's so much change and so many things you can't take along.
Mm.
But composers who have been lucky to live a long time, I think that profile is interesting, that there are things available at certain times and then they're not available. and other things come along. But that's right now the way I'm feeling. I tend to have my cutting room floor has gotten very large. I've got a lot of room on my cutting room floor.
You describe it, and certainly the printed score even came out this way, that you were inspired by the times of day. And it actually makes me think of the Haydn day part symphonies, right? The morning, noon, and evening symphonies. And I just wonder if when you hear this piece now, you've listened to it as the BSO has rehearsed it, do you hear as clearly that inspiration as you had hoped you would?
Yeah, I do. And I'm very surprised how well I remember the notes of the piece, because it's been a number of decades. But I started just the last few years going back over older pieces that I hadn't really thought about for a while. And the surprising thing was always just actually whatever judgment or whatever reaction I had to them, I did remember the detail, which I was a little surprised by that. I knew I would remember things when I wrote when I was 17 years old, because your memory is strong at that age. But I was a little more surprised that I could really recall things still pretty well. And sometimes with a feeling that I don't know why they came out that way at that time, but that doesn't mean that they're still quite apprehendable. When I think of in the abstract about a given piece, they're usually at least large swatches of that are still very clear in my head. I guess it's because, you know, you sit around and ponder. I was reading a lot about people who meditate, you know, that build that into their lives. I think composers, a lot of what you do is you sit around and wait. And then in the present time, what I do is sit around, wait, and write down a lot of stuff which I can't use. And the stuff I cannot use has grown much larger in proportion to what I can. but that is still that process. The meditation process is probably kind of a balancing thing too. If you're not somebody who wants to sit and wait, you probably would be better off doing something else. There's no other way to do it, really.
I
love reading about other composers, old composers, what they did. I mean, Stravinsky used to play older music, you know.
Yeah.
He would say, and the wait for a little leap in his spirit. He said, well, he plays Schütz and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Haydn strummed on the piano, which is interesting because his piano music is not really at the center of his creation. And what he would often do after improvising on the piano, we'd write symphonies and quartets. So clearly the fingers are not dictating to him the shape of those ideas, but something about his mind needs a process of meditating of that sort. I think that that's all. I think that's very relatable to all kinds of other modes of life where everyone has to develop some habits that will make them able to function, to do something.
Yeah. And as I listen to you and as I've kept up with your 80th birthday year, I've built this impression, and tell me if I'm wrong, but there's very little that you are looking back on with dismay or regret or wondering what you were thinking. I mean, you sound like you have a very healthy relationship with your past, which I wish maybe more people had that.
Well, I sort of took that on as a problem a few years ago because I thought I needed to actually check through my pieces, and particularly ones that had been performed much, some that had been performed only once, just to see what was in there, whether it was what I remembered. And this was very helpful. It was not helpful to the creation of new pieces. But it was certainly helpful because, of course, I was squeezing my terrain a lot. but at the same time, it was helpful in another way of feeling, understanding why I was where I was in each given instance. I mean, just thinking, well, in many cases, I had to see that through, you know. And that's a lot of what you feel like composing is like. You know, you're in a situation and you think, well, and it has nothing to do with having commission or anything else. It's like you become committed to seeing where this goes.
Yeah.
And often because some of the time in the process, you don't really exactly know where it's going. I always tell my composition students at Tanglewood when we talk about writing program notes that one of the things we need to do for the public is give the impression we do know what we're going. I don't think people want to read.
Behind the curtain now, John.
People really don't want to read anything very real about the process because it's so strange and so completely not very predictable.
Right.
I think we have to, our professional responsibility is to give the impression that this was a wonderful, inevitable outcome. But I think that for composers down through the years, there are always so many surprises and so many veers and even in things which turn out to be very lucid formally, there are probably turns in the road that could not possibly have been guessed.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm so glad that this is the symphony that the BSO chose. I really do love this symphony. It's just so beautiful. And as I mentioned before, the textures are something that I found unexpected from your music, but that I, you know, from all the music I love of yours. And so... So thanks for taking some time to talk with me about it and all the 80 years that you've been here and with us and producing great music.
Well, whoever chose it over here at the BSO, I'm grateful too, because it's definitely a piece I wanted to hear again too.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.